Tonight's subject is Maimonides, the Rambam, and I think it's important to learn about him. The Talmud says, Gadol Shimusha Yoser Milimuda, which means that greater is one who serves and is close with a scholar than one who learns from them. In other words, you can learn a tremendous amount from the way a person acts, from the way a person speaks, from the life of a great scholar. It says, Afilu Sichas Chulin, Shel Tamidei Chachamim Tzricha Limud, even the idle chatter of a great scholar needs study. You can pick up things from it. I know that, for example, Rav Moshe Shapiro, just the way he speaks sometimes, he will say, when he talks about someone, he quotes someone who's deceased, he will say, Shamati Ma'adam Gadol Echad, I heard from a certain great man, She'enenu Chai Itanu, which means who doesn't live with us.
He didn't say he doesn't live. He says he doesn't live with us.
It's an important thing. That's how you speak. Then that gives you a reality. There is an idea that the soul is still alive. Or, for example, when he would say, we're going to be meeting next Tuesday at 8 o'clock, he would say, Im yigzor Hashem b'chayim. If God decrees life, we're going to meet next Tuesday. Right, that's a little more heavy than the mitzvah, which is about, whatever, which is said usually in a meaningless fashion. So that's what I'd like to talk about the Rambam. Also, for a second reason, aside from what we can learn from his language, from his life, etc., and what inspiration we can draw from him, also is to correct, to a certain degree, a little bit of a unidimensional view. I remember I was on the bus in Unsdorf, in Israel. Unsdorf is a neighborhood of Jerusalem, it's one of the seven dwarfs. I was on the bus with a friend of mine, and we were discussing, actually having a violent argument, but anyway, we were discussing about why it is the Chafetz Chaim, very, very famous Chafetz Chaim, is well known primarily as a tzaddik, righteous man. Although he was also a great genius. Anyone who has learned through his Torah works of the Chafetz Chaim, for instance, the Mishnah Brura, commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, Biur Halacha, a super commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, his work on Lashon Hara, you'll see that he was a genius, an Elohi, an incredible scholar. But he is not well known for that. He is, when you think of the Chafetz Chaim, if you do a word association, or Rorschach, I'll show you what Chafetz Chaim is like, right, that's another thing. So that's how we think of it. Why? So we were discussing why that is so. So as we were involved in this discussion, Edgar buses have these seats sitting across from each other, so you can be social when you don't want to be, right? So anyway, Rav Simcha Wasserman gets on the bus together with Rav Zaks. So Rav Simcha Wasserman, the son, was the son of Rav Elchanan Wasserman, the greatest student of the Chafetz Chaim. And Rav Zaks was the grandson of the Chafetz Chaim. So here we are having this discussion, and who gets on the bus, and they sit right opposite us, was the grandson of the Chafetz Chaim, and the son of the greatest student of the Chafetz Chaim. So we figured, thank you, Hashem. And we asked them the question. So they both smiled, and it was a question that they'd thought of, obviously. So Rav Simcha Wasserman said, he says, very simple. He said, the Chafetz Chaim knew how much he knew. He knew that he was a genius. He knew that he was a great scholar. So he prayed to Hashem every day that he should not become famous for his scholarship. But he didn't know he was a tzaddik. So he didn't pray to Hashem that he shouldn't be well known as a tzaddik, as a righteous person. Right? So, in other words, it's possible to know that you know a lot of Torah. It's possible to know that you are very, very brilliant. But he didn't think of himself as righteous, as a tzaddik. And therefore, he never entered his mind to pray, I shouldn't become famous as a tzaddik. So therefore, he did become famous as a tzaddik, but God answered his prayers, he didn't become famous as the genius. So why I'm mentioning that is because if you would do the same word association game with Maimonides, right, if I would say Rambam, what would most people answer? Genius. Right, like he's some type of supercomputer. Right, the Cray 613 supercomputer sitting there in Egypt, right, just calculating stuff, and there's no human side to him, and there is no emotional side to him. Just think of him as this brain sitting there in Egypt with a turban, right? So that's not exactly how it was. And there's a third reason I'd like to speak about it. Third reason is that when all the, you know, you look at biographies of great people, especially those written recently in the past, which, well, most of them have been written recently. I used to not write biographies. It wasn't something that people did. But in the past 30, 40 years, you look at the biographies of any great person, they're almost identical. I mean, it's unbelievable, right? You could just substitute any name. You could just write one biography and have those circle things they have in kids' books where you turn it around and you get a different thing in the box. And you just have a different name of a rabbi on the disc and just turn it, right? You know, Judas, right? Covered Tanakh and Mishnah by the time he was 5, out through his teachers by the time he was 10, right? You know, that type of thing, and it's all the same, right? So, Uziel Maleski, Oliver Sholem, used to say that he felt that type of thing is a great disservice because it dehumanizes them, and therefore there's nothing that we can emulate. Because I look at them and I say, well, I didn't cover, Tanakh by the time I was 5. It was at least 7, I think. But I mean, I didn't, you know, that was a joke. I didn't really. Okay. You see this, I didn't cover it by that time. So I didn't outdo my teachers, you know, by the time I was 12. So what's there for me to do? Nothing. So, of course, if they're that type of, if that's how you look at it, no struggles, nothing, you know, no evil inclination, of course, right, no idiosyncrasies, nothing. So then what's the use of such a thing? Right, you're just sitting there and it's basically just hero worship, and it doesn't actually inspire you to do anything because there's no way you can imitate that which is already perfect from birth. So, therefore, I think it's worthwhile sometimes looking at a biography, but not just for the dates and figures, etc., facts and figures, but I think we can learn a lot from it. So, hence, that's a little bit of an intro. So, we are talking tonight about Moshe ben Maimon, Moses, son of Maimon. Maimon is his father's name, and it's a Spanish name, actually, quite interesting. It's not a Jewish name, it's a Spanish name. And,
Do you know what it means?
Haven't got a clue. Ne habla español.
Well,
I don't know. It's usually pronounced Maimon. It could be it's Mimun, but it is indeed a Spanish name. And actually, the way I know that is because Reb Moshe Feinstein has a responsa, a tshuva, about someone asked him, is it permitted to use my secular name? Obviously, someone who, let's say, became religious and they've got the name. You know, their slave name was Yolanda, and she wants to know if she can change it to Yenta, you know, or can she still be known as Yolanda, right? Should she answer to it, right? Or some guy, Biff, right, now Boruch, right? So is Boruch, is it permitted to still be known as Biff? Is there something wrong with that? So Reb Moshe Feinstein says, no, there's nothing wrong with that. He says, it's okay to have this second language to actually answer to it. It could be you have a preference, and we certainly have a preference for a authentic Hebrew Jewish name, right? But the fact of the matter is, he says it is something which is permissible, and he actually quotes that the father of Maimonides was indeed Maimon, which he says is a Spanish name. So, but his father was a dayan, a judge in the community in Spain. So, but he's known as Maimonides, which is basically the son of Maimon, and he was born in Cordoba, Spain, 14th of Nisan, 1135. So, born in 1135. In Cordoba, in Spain. At the time in Spain, Spain was ruled by Muslims. The Muslims ruled Spain, they called it Al-Andalus, Andalusia, and they controlled Spain. When he was about 16, Cordoba was captured by the Almohads. The Almohads were fundamentalist Muslims, and they were, I guess, pretty much like, you hear about the Taliban. So the Almohads were the Taliban of the ancient world, and this is 1148, and they made a decree that all who live under their territory, in their territory, under their control, will have to convert to Islam or die. And so Maimonides' family had to flee Cordoba in Spain, and they lived in hiding in Spain. They wandered in Spain. I have here for approximately, according to some historians, approximately 11 years. They lived in the countryside and in hiding. During that time, very difficult life, as you can imagine. But during that time, Maimonides' father taught him Torah. His father himself was a student of the Rebbe Gash, who was a student of Yitzhak Alfasi. Rebbe Yitzhak Alfasi, right, it's not a reference to his hair. Alfasi actually is Arabic for Al-Fez, from Fez in Morocco. It's interesting, Maimonides says that his father would tremble with fear when he mentioned the name of Reb Yitzhak Alfasi, because he was in such awe of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. So it was amazing people, and Maimonides learned from his father, who was a student of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi. From Spain, they moved to Morocco. They were wandering in Spain until 1159. They moved to Fez in Morocco in 1159. So they moved to Morocco. It is believed that also there was Islamic persecution in Morocco, and they had to live disguised as Muslims for a while in Morocco, and were persecuted there as well. And then they went to Israel. The year they left for Israel was 1165. So 1165, he's born in 1135, so he's now 30 years old. By the way, I should point out that he wrote his first book, which was on mathematical logic, when he was about 18, and he wrote another book when he was 19. He wrote a number of books on logic, mathematics, astronomy, etc. And when he was in his 20s, early 20s, he wrote a book called The Siraj, which is Arabic, it means the light, and it's actually a commentary on Mishnah, the entire Mishnah. And what it does is, obviously, it's a flashlight, looks at the Mishnah. You know, the Mishnah is very much written very cryptically. As you know, the sages wanted to preserve the idea of the oral tradition. That is to say, they didn't want everything to be written out. Because when everything is written out, it's too accessible. So you'll say, today, of course, it's the common belief that everything should be accessible to absolutely everyone, at all times, all places, in all situations, you know, no matter what you're wearing or not wearing. Everything should be that. That's how it is, right? However, there's a certain, we don't actually agree with that. Shockingly enough, we would say no. You know, the idea of the Torah is meant to be the covenant between God and the Jewish people. As such, a covenant, we don't want it to be equally shared by everyone. Right? If there's an exclusivity and an intimacy about the Jewish people's connection to God, that is actually one of the reasons that the Torah, most of the Torah, was not given in a written form. Most of the Torah was given in an oral form, and therefore, to retain that exclusivity. That's therefore, it was like something which, if you were part of the club, you'd know about the Torah. And if you weren't, you wouldn't know about it. And since the Jews lived in exile, right, God did not want the Torah to be stolen, plagiarized, which is what happened. Think of the written Torah. What has happened to the written Torah? Communities all over the world basically ripped it off. Right? The Christians, you ask any person on the street, well, I guess outside of Brooklyn area, but you ask any person on the street who said, love your neighbor as yourself, the vast majority of people will not say Moses. The vast majority of people will say Jesus. Right? The reason is because it's misquoted in Matthew 5, where it says, you have heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemy, etc., turn the other cheek. Right? But that's aside from being a misquote, everyone attributes it to the wrong person and to the wrong religion. Right? And that has happened to a lot of the Torah. It's interesting, divine providence organized that the Christian scriptures were actually put together first before the Mishnah was written down. Why is that? Very significant divine providence there. Because had the Mishnah been already written before the Christian scriptures were put together, what would they have also misused and plagiarized? The Mishnah. So thank God that was saved. Right? So it's very cryptic. And you need to fill in lots of words and you need to get lots of explanations. So the Rambam wanted to make the Mishnah accessible to the Jewish people. And he wrote a very amazing commentary on the Mishnah. It's called the Siraj. Just to give you an idea of the times, 1158 is when he wrote his first book. So he was born in 1135. So 1158 makes him 23. So his first book.
The Guide to the Paper?
No, totally different book. No, we'll get to that. That's much later. So in 1158, he wrote something called Mamara Ibur, which is basically astronomy, mathematics, clearly and concisely explained. He then wrote a book called Milati Dayon. I'm not exactly sure of the year, but it was very close to that first book. And this book is on a book about logic. Not an easy subject, but a book about logic. And the Siraj, he began writing at 1158. So keep in mind, that was just after they'd been thrown out of Spain and were living in great under great persecution in Morocco. So he's not sitting in an air-conditioned office with a word processor and a secretary, right, and dictating while sipping some beer or something like that. Right? What he's doing is, he is living a difficult life, right, on the run to a certain degree, refugees, and he was writing works of astronomy, mathematics, and logic. And then a commentary on the Mishnah, which he started writing then, which was again written in Arabic. By the way, in the commentary of the Mishnah is where we find the first appearance of the 13 principles of faith, You know, the Animamin that we say in the Siddur, the Animamin, the I believe statements, 13 statements, which are in the prayer book, they're actually not, that's not what Maimonides wrote. That's a shortened version, anonymously written, which is in the prayer books. But that's not the language of Maimonides. Maimonides originally wrote them, they're much longer. They're like, each one is like a significant paragraph, and they're not written in Hebrew, they're actually written in Arabic. Because that was the lingua franca of probably about 80% of the Jews at that time was Arabic. So most Jewish works, philosophy, etc., and law were written in Arabic. So he leaves for Israel. There's a very fascinating letter attributed to Maimonides from that trip to Israel. He writes how they're in the sea on the way to the port of Akko, from Morocco to Akko, and there was a huge storm, and the ship was in danger of sinking. And he said he went below decks and he meditated and prayed to God. And he says, from that time onwards, they were saved from death. From that time onwards, he said, he declared a fast day, that he accepted upon himself a fast day on that day that they were saved from drowning. He said, and that day he said he would spend in prayer, and in prayer alone, he says, just as he was alone with God at that time and God saved his life, he would spend that day alone with God for all the rest of his life and have a fast day on that day. They land in Akko. And here's an amazing, they land in the port of Akko. It's the first time he's set foot in the land of Israel. How many of us, maybe some of us do, but do we remember the date that we first set foot on Israel? The exact date we first, anyone who's been to Israel, the exact date that you first set foot on the soil of Israel? For us, it's a hassle. The seats were too crowded in El Al, right? The food was frozen, the food was too hot, right? There was a baby crying behind me, right? You get to Israel, there's a huge rush in the old days from the bus to passport control, trampling people under feet, right? You know, that everyone has to, right? And nowadays you get to Israel and you see, and you're greeted by the traditional biblical Nokia sign, right? And, but of course, at that point, Maimonides, he lands in Israel, he says, on the day he first set foot on the Holy Land of Israel, he is declaring it a Yontif, a festival in his family for all generations. They should celebrate it with feasting, wearing their Shabbat clothing, giving charity and saying psalms. To commemorate and celebrate the day he had the merit to set foot on the Holy Land. Then, he says, after a long journey, they finally came to Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, he came to the Western Wall, and he says he declared another Yom Tov in his family, another festive day in his family, to remember the first day that he had the merit to pray at the gates of heaven at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. So now, the Rambam's trip to Israel, instead of producing some stupid t-shirt and a keychain, has produced in his family a fast day and a day of meditation and repentance and prayer where you're alone with God because they were saved from drowning. It has produced the Yom Tov to celebrate the day that he first merited setting foot on the shores of the Holy Land, and a second Yom Tov to celebrate when he first merited praying at the Western Wall. We don't even bother. We just go to the cocktail cam. Okay, right, yeah, but, you know, touch the camera. Right, so then they went to Hebron, the tomb of the patriarchs and matriarchs, Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, and Leah. And he prayed there, and he created yet another festival in his family. He said to commemorate the day that he would merit it to pray at the grave of his ancestors, such a merit was inconceivable to him. So that was someone who was not just a computer. When I was talking about people think of the brain, right? No, there's a tremendous passion and an emotional side here where he sees and recognizes the greatness and the holiness of the land of Israel and celebrates when it's appropriate to celebrate. It's an amazing thing. So then eventually in Israel, he only stayed for a short time. There was a Christian presence in the land of Israel, and there were rumors that they wanted to kidnap Maimonides, the Crusaders, and hold them for ransom. So in 1167, he and his family left Israel and went to Cairo, actually Old Cairo, which was known at the time as Fostat. Not sure if I'm pronouncing correctly, but Fostat was Old Cairo. That's where the Rambam settled. It's interesting to note that Maimonides himself, in his Mishneh Torah, which we'll talk about soon, he writes that it's permitted to live anywhere in the world except for Egypt. And there he was, tragically living in Egypt. Of course, the commentaries immediately, the Radvaz and others, ask how could he have lived in Egypt when he himself rules that it's prohibited. And the answer is very, very simple. It's not like he you know, got a map of the world and say, oh, Egypt looks nice. Right, it was, you know, he was living in Spain, he was thrown out of Spain, had to run for their lives from the Almohad Muslim crazies. Right, then he was in Morocco, they had to run for their lives from other Muslims. Then they're in Israel, and he has to leave because the crusade. It's not like he had options. You know, he had to get a visa somewhere else. So the closest civilized country with a Jewish community was Cairo, was Egypt rather, and so he moved to Egypt. It's not one of the commandments, but I must die rather than transgress. In other words, there are commandments, idolatry, for example, you have to die rather than transgress. But the prohibition against living in Egypt is not one of those cardinal sins, and hence, to save your life, you're certainly allowed to live there. And so he joined the Jewish community there, and of course that's... and while he was there, he wrote numerous works. First of all, he started with his letters. And the letters are a very, very significant part of Maimonides, which a lot of people are not aware of, but there are literally hundreds of letters that Maimonides wrote on every conceivable subject to an incredibly wide range of people. Well before the internet, the Rambam was the World Wide Web. He was connected everywhere. People were asking questions. People in France were writing to him and asking questions. People in Yemen asking questions. Jewish communities all over the Jewish world, which was Middle East, parts of Europe, North Africa, etc., were writing questions to Maimonides, and he was answering those questions. And he wrote beautiful treaties to the Jews in Yemen, two letters, and he wrote a letter to Jews who were under Islamic persecution, where he, first of all, he harshly criticized rabbis who said that people must die rather than openly admit to believing in Allah. Because he says, you know, it's not idolatry, because Islam is, in fact, monotheistic religion. And he also criticized the Jewish communities, who there were people who, under the force, force majeure, there was a tremendous pressure, at the pain of death and torture to convert. And there, when the that Islamic Inquisition ended, there were people in the Jewish community who did not accept Jews back. You know, Jews who had become, ostensibly Muslims during that persecution wanted to return to the Jewish community, and they were rejected by certain people. And Maimonides writes in an amazing letter, very, very beautifully, he says, this Torah is eternal, and your Judaism is eternal. He says, a person can never escape Judaism. He says, that is their essence. He says, the fact of the matter, even if a person has transgressed every sin in the book, that person is still Jewish. He says, Yerovaam ben Nevat Shchikat Samot. Jeroboam, the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, who was Chayte Umachti Esarabim, who sinned and caused others to sin, did not allow Jews to make pilgrimage to Jerusalem. He actually built a calf, an idol. He created a whole new festival, B'chodesh Asher Badam Libor, with an invention of his own. It was a horrific, horrific man. Russia, evil man. Maimonides says he'll also be punished for not sitting in the sukkah on Sukkos. Meaning, there's no such thing as saying, well, I've done this, this, and this, and this, so who cares about the rest of this stuff? Oh, no. He says every single thing. He is still Jewish. He says, Zera Abraham Enoch Kale, he says, the seed of Abraham will never end. And he says, these people are Jewish, and he quotes an interesting verse in Proverbs, Mishlei, which says, Al Yavuzul Ganav Ki Yignov, which means, don't despise the thief who comes to steal. Stranger, what type of verse? Don't despise the thief who comes to steal. He says this refers to a Jew who sneaks into the shul, the synagogue, to steal a little bit of Torah, to steal a little bit of Judaism. He's embarrassed. He became a Muslim. He lived as a Muslim for a year, 2 years, under the Inquisition. And now he comes, he's standing at the back of the shul. He says, and you tell him, get out, you're a Muslim. He says, don't do that. Don't despise the thief who comes to steal. He's a holy thief, Shlomo Carlebach would say. He's a holy thief, right? He's coming to steal a little bit of Judaism from the back of the shul. You know, it's amazing. That's the type of thing, if I would have asked people who said that, right, most people would have said Shlomo. Right? And he's not the type of person you'd associate with Maimonides, Shlomo Carlebach. You know what I mean? It's a sign of Maimonides that has a tremendous, tremendous love for Jews. And in his letter to these Jewish communities, he takes into consideration all these factors, takes into consideration the fact that people were forced and it's very difficult to sustain if you're tortured and persecuted, etc. And he is very sympathetic to those, even though he says actually, when it comes to idolatry, one has to die rather than transgress, but he nevertheless says that one who does transgress is not considered to be culpable, because nevertheless there was tremendous pressure. It was considered anus, beyond their control. And, not exactly certain, but they have to accept Muhammad as a prophet, which is not true, but it's also not idolatry. Because accepting Muhammad as a prophet is different from Christianity is the idea that Jesus is actually God. Right? That's blasphemous and it's idolatry. But Muhammad, right, is not looked at as a god, but as a prophet. So we say that's not true. He was not a prophet, right? But it's also not idolatry to say that he was. Whereas Allah, right, when they say Allah, they're referring to God, right, creator of heaven and earth, and then hence there's no problem with that. Yeah, but that's not. I don't want to get into a discussion about Islam now. This is not really the subject. It's more about Maimonides than Islam. But that's basically the idea. So it's interesting. He comes to Egypt. And in Egypt, we'll get to his works a little bit later, but in Egypt, he's in Fostat, Cairo, and he comes to this family. He had a brother, David. David was a great businessman, and he traded, believed in gemstones, precious metals, gemstones, and he had, and he used to go as far as, some say he actually went as far as India in his trade, and he supported Maimonides, he supported the Rambam. So the Rambam was able to study and to teach Torah and to write his books because he had the support of his brother David. Unfortunately, his brother was on a ship and the ship sunk and no insurance at those times, so his fortune sank with him and his brother died. And Maimonides now had to take on the burden of supporting his own family and also his brother's widow and children. And he writes in his book, in his letters, that he never ever really recovered from the death of his brother David. He describes him as, not only was he my brother, he was also my teacher and was also my student and was also my closest friend. And he said that whenever he would see something, for the rest of his life, whenever he would see something that belonged to his brother, he says he would cry with the memory of his brother. They were very, very close to family. It wasn't just that, there was a strong, he says, he learned from him, he taught him. They were close in a tremendous bond. And he said for days, for maybe weeks after he heard of his brother's death, he said he was bedridden from grief and physically sick from the fact that his brother died. But he had to now support his family. He refused. He felt that it was wrong to make a living from the teaching of Torah and the study of Torah. He writes about this extensively. He feels it is a desecration. I mean, he's pretty strong language about it. He says it's a desecration of the name of God. He says it is extinguishing the light of Judaism, and it is abusing and disgracing the Torah to make a living from Torah. Obviously, there are those who disagree with him, right, and the Code of Jewish Law does, but Maimonides of that opinion. So at that time, he'd already learnt enough medicine to become a doctor on his own, and he became the physician of the caliph, or the Arab ruler, the Egyptian court, 1185. He became the ruler. He became the official physician of the court in Egypt, in Cairo. Then afterwards, the person who took over was now by the name of Salah al-Din. In English, we call him Saladin, and he was the personal physician of the court of Saladin. What that meant was, and there's a very interesting letter from that time. As I mentioned, his works were written in Arabic. So there were Jews who did not speak Arabic. Jews of France, for example, spoke French, and that was not their language. Jews of Germany, etc. So the one universal language that all Jews could relate to was Hebrew. So there was a family of translators in France called the Ibn Tibbon family, and one of them was translating the works of Maimonides, and he writes a letter to Maimonides. That he said, I prefer to use the term Rambam from now. Okay, but he writes to Rambam and he says to him, I'd like to come and visit you and discuss some issues in the translation. I mean, you're translating a work and the author's alive. You want to speak to him, right, and get the different nuances and what he's saying, etc. What do you mean by this? It's very important. So first of all, the letter Maimonides writes to him glowing approbation for Yuri Ibn Tibbon's translation work. He says, you have grasped what a translator should do, which is not to be a literal translator, but to grasp the idea and translate the idea into the language, as opposed to translating literally from the language and putting the idea second. The idea has got to come first and the language second. That's the important thing to do. And he says, however, I know that you'd love to come and see me. He says, and I love you like my own son. He says, but you have to understand, it's a difficult and arduous journey from France to Egypt. There are risks involved. And he says, let me tell you my day, and you'll answer me if you think it's worth coming. He says, I wake up before dawn so that I can pray with the rising of the sun, which is what you ideally meant to do. He says, I then travel, after grabbing a bite to eat, I then travel to the court in Cairo, which is close to an hour's journey. I then administer to the needs, the medical needs of the Sultan, of all his court, his harem, all of the people there. He says he apparently also offered psychological counsel to people. He was a man of insight into the soul and into emotion. And aside from being a physician he was a holistic physician, so to speak. He felt like you should deal with the entire person, not just with the wart, right? It's got to be the whole person, right? Anyway, so, and he says that takes me to the late afternoon. He says, I then can pray afternoon service. He says, I then head for home. I usually get home, it's nighttime. And he says, by the time I get home, there's already a line of people waiting outside my surgery to see me. He says, Jews, Gentiles, rich, poor, etc. He says, I then go through the line to see if there's anyone who needs something urgently. I apologize to people for keeping them waiting. I then go into my surgery and start seeing patients. He says, about a few hours later, he says, I'm so exhausted, I have to lie on the couch and I treat my patients while I'm lying down and they're standing up. He then says, this brings us to close to midnight, when I have some time to eat something and then to learn some Torah. She says, so, you could come and visit, but there's not much time that we'd be able to talk. You'd have to stand in line with everyone else. Right, I could meet you for a few minutes. He says, it is not worth the risk, the expense, and the exhaustion of going on this journey to speak to me for 5 minutes. So that gives you an idea a little bit about how what his day was like, etc. There are many legends about the time he was a physician. We do know that he established one of the first public hospitals, and we do know he was very heavily, he had a lot of responsibility, or rather he was responsible for a lot of the ideas of hygiene. People did not have an association of dirt and disease. In fact, the connection between dirt and disease was not really realized or discovered until I think it was the 1800s, early 1800s, by the Belgian priest who discovered it. But Maimonides was of the opinion, as a physician, he was heavily of the opinion that prophylactic medicine was ideal, preventative medicine, as opposed to intervention. And he said, if a person exercises, and the type of exercise he says should be fun, ideally. I didn't see this myself. My good friend Rabbi Rietti said he saw in one of Maimonides' medical works that Maimonides recommends playing ball games. Because exercise is only going to be good if you're actually in a good mood when you do it. Right? So he says if it's something which is boring and tedious, he says the person's not going to keep it up and it's not going to have maximum benefit. He says if you're in a psychological state which is down and depressed, not good for you either. So therefore he recommends, and he says a healthy diet, he says nothing in excess, and so amazing, I mean, medical advice, which much of his medical advice is still relevant today. He says because all intervention in terms of medicine is always going to be, there's always going to be some negative side effect. You take one pill, so it gets rid of the headache, messes up your digestive system, right? So you prefer to have a messed up digestive system than to have the massive headache. So you're choosing one side effect over another. But he says that's almost always the case. So he says, and one of the things he did was that he actually told people, in fact, his first daughter died in an epidemic in Cairo, and he was responsible for really cleaning up a lot of the streets and giving the people the understanding of the importance of hygiene and cleanliness, much of which he derived from the words of our sages in the Talmud and other sources. Interesting to note, by the way, that in 1187, when Saladin captured Jerusalem from the Crusaders, he actually allowed the Jews to enter Jerusalem, something which the Christians did not do, and something which other Muslims beforehand did not do. And I don't know, it's not impossible to confirm this, but it could have been on the advice of his doctor. Then to his life, he died on the 20th of Tevet in 1204, and his remains were brought to Tiberias, Tiberia, and buried there, which is where his grave is today. So that's a little bit of a sketched outline of the life of the Rambam and the various periods of his life. I just have a look at the works. What did he produce in terms of his writings? So we mentioned the Ma'amar HaIbur, which is astronomy and mathematics. Milat HaGayon, which was on logic, and the Sirat, which is the commentary on the Mishnah, which contains in it the, three famous things in his commentary on the Mishnah. One is his introduction to the entire Mishnah, which is a masterpiece in which he details the transmission of the oral law and actually records all the individuals involved in the oral law transmission, and also there, just exhibiting tremendous knowledge. I mean, he didn't have a computer or a CD-ROM, right? But listing basically every single sage, how often he's mentioned in the Mishnah, all the various arguments. It's such an amazing introduction to it. Secondly, is his introduction to Ethics of the Fathers, which is called Shmoneh Prakim, which means eight chapters, which is his psychological treatise. Interesting thing he says there. I'll just pick out one or two, but one interesting thing he says there, he says someone who's suffering from depression, depression should be looked at without embarrassment. It's a sickness. He says, and like all sicknesses, it should be treated. And that's an interesting thing because, you know, a lot of people look at things like that and it's somehow separate. It's not a disease. It's like something to be embarrassed of, etc. But seriously, he says, if a person has mild depression, one of the things he recommends, he says, wearing your best clothing. He says, go and spend lots of money. Right, buy things that you like, listen to good music, hang out with friends, and eat good foods. It's got the days before Prozac, right? This is actually wonderful advice, right? To spend time with friends, to see beautiful things, nothing like that, something of beauty just lifts you up. I'm still on the high, by the way, so I just got back from 9 days in South Africa. With 40 students, Rabbi Tatz and I took 40 students to South Africa, and we went on a safari to Kruger. Right? And the natural beauty of Africa is, I mean, I've never seen anything like it. To see a herd of elephants, right, in the natural environment, we saw two baby elephants, right, with this herd of about 20 elephants, two babies there. They leaped, they're standing next to each other, and they touched by touching their trunks to each other. I don't think I've ever seen anything as cute as that, right? But it's an amazing thing. It just like lifts you up when you see things like that. It's incredible. I'm sorry for my own kids, but the truth is they're a little cuter, I think. Whatever, anyway. But don't tell my kids. Anyway, if you're watching, join me. Anyway, so the other famous thing, that's the eight chapters where he gives his pretty much his understanding of the human soul, human psychology. That is his introduction to Shmoneh Prakim. Interesting thing he says there, by the way, it's a little controversial. One of the things he says there is that emotions are not a sin, meaning he says sin is possible in action and it's possible in intellectual beliefs. He says, but emotions, not a sin. In other words, if I feel angry at someone, I haven't committed an avera, that's not a sin. He says, because that very much is not really under the control of someone. Now, if I express the anger and yell at you, if I express the anger and hit you, God forbid, right, if I express the anger and rip something up, that's an action. That's already under my control. He says, but it's not considered a sin to have an emotion. I desire something which is wrong. He says, okay, if I control my desire, I don't actually act it out, then I haven't transgressed it. It's a very interesting, quite controversial. A lot of people argue with that. But, yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting. The Rambam could be that he would say that only if it's actually, I'm not so clear about sinas chinam, right? That might be something which you control, because if you feel initial hatred and then you encourage it, that's already where the sin is. But the initial impulse that someone does something to me, like, and just, right, etc., that might be not the sin. The sin might be the continued encouragement of it, dwelling. So that's already where the intellect comes in. I'm dwelling on what they did to me. I'm thinking about it, right? I'm writing it in my diary. I'm so to speak, focused on it. So that might be the sin. But the initial impulse that you just feel anger at someone, you feel that, you know, that type of thing towards someone, I don't think that necessarily is the sin. So it's interesting. He also talks about there, as I mentioned, also the 13 principles of faith. There was a lot of controversy about those, the 13 principles of faith. There were some who critiqued it by saying, what do you mean 13? You have to believe in everything in the Torah. How can you condense it into 13 principles? What's going on here? There are some who said, what 13? Only three. Right. So what's interesting is how universally accepted was Maimonides' 13 principles. Think of it. Virtually every sitter you open up, any sitter, will have printed Animanim, the 13 principles of belief, right, after Davening Shabbat. And one of the most famous Jewish songs is really a summary of the 13 principles. And it's printed also in every song. Yigdal, Elohim Chai. People know that Yigdal, right? You should have little kids singing Yigdal, yeah, that type of thing. Right, Yigdal actually is 13 do the comparison. If you're not aware of this, probably most of you are, but if you do the comparison, take out Yigdal, and then look at the Siddur at Ani Namin. Every verse of Yigdal is one of the 13 principles of faith. Right? The Kabbalists talk about the 13 principles of faith and relate them to the 13 attributes of mercy of God, the Yud Gimel Milos Rachamim, the Shalom. Shalom Zabriz does that. So it was accepted, like, amazingly how it's accepted. And one of those anonymous condensations of Maimonides' 13 principles, Ani Namin, the Emunah Shleima, the Vias HaMashiach, I believe in the coming of the Messiah, that's something which became something the Jews died with as on their lips. So to tell you how accepted it was, Maimonides' formulation was just amazing. And we believe there's a certain, as Chavnish points this out, there's what we call siyata d'shmaya, a certain help from heaven, that certain books, certain concepts, certain ideas, certain prayers become accepted amongst the Jewish people. Think of Lecha Dodi, a beautiful song written very late in history. We're talking about 1600s. I mean, that, by Jewish standards, that's like very modern. Right, that's like, you know, true, totally modern, right? The modernist song, right? But nevertheless, accepted, you know, all over the world by many communities. But Maimonides' 13 principles even more accepted than Lecha Dodi. So that's in the commentary on the Mishnah. He then wrote 1163 an amazing work, Ma'amar Kiddush Hashem, which he gave advice to Jewish communities who were confronted by Inquisition-like events. He wrote Igeres Teiman, the letter to Yemen in 1172, otherwise known as Petach Tikva, which means the opening of hope. And there he gives a tremendous encouragement to the Yemenite community who had undergone tremendous persecution. He writes there, this persecution was predicted. He says, the Torah tells us, in the prophets, it says that you will be afflicted. There will people who will try to destroy you by the sword and by the tongue. By the sword are those who rise up against to try to kill us physically. And by the tongue are those who are trying to convince us, right, to abandon our Judaism. He says, but the Torah tells us that these will not succeed, and he says they will pass over, and that no one will succeed against us in either of these. And he says, you should know that people who do succumb to this and completely convert to these other religions, probably their ancestors did not stand at Mount Sinai. He says, do not be perturbed by these events. He says, but you should know that no one has a foundation like our Torah, where there was a public revelation of God to an entire people. He says, people have tried to imitate the Torah, but the imitations of the Torah, he says, are like statues. A statue is an imitation of a human being, but the statue has no emotion. The statue has no life, the statue has no movement, the statue has no inner organs. He says, that's what they're like. They have the external trappings, and that's it. Now he says, and this too was predicted. In the book of Daniel it says that there will be people who arise, as we said, with the sword, that's physical destruction. With the tongue, that's convince us to convert. He says, there'll be those who arise from amongst us, that it says, and they will attempt to set up a vision, but they will fail. The vision that they see of Judaism will be a failure. It will not be the Judaism they really want. And it says, I don't remember the apostle, but it says, Yakumu Lahakim Chazon, I think is the expression. They'll get up to rise up to build a vision, and they will fail.
So this is a reference to the Erev Rav?
Very possibly, yeah.
It
does, yes. I think I quoted this when I spoke about the Erev Rav here. So that's the Igeret Teiman, and it's really beautiful to see the words of encouragement he offers to the community. Then he wrote, completed in 1170, is another book which really had tremendous impact, which is his Sefer HaMitzvot, in which he wrote a list, an authoritative list of all 613 commandments. I mean, there were those who criticized it. Nachmanides has an entire book in which he critiques the Rambam's count of 613 commandments, but until his time, there was no one who really had this comprehensive book that details every single one. Because in the Torah itself, it doesn't actually say this is commandment number one, this is commandment number 25. It doesn't do that. It just has verses, and you're supposed to figure it out. But Maimonides wrote this incredible comprehensive list, all 613 commandments, preceded by the rules by which he counts something as a commandment. Not everything that is in the Torah is counted in the 613. For example, God told the Jews to put blood on their doorposts. Is that one of the 613? No, because it was only momentary. It was only for that time. He says, the commandments were only for one time. And there arose an entire literature, right, discussing why did Maimonides include this one, exclude that one, etc., etc. One of the most famous ones he excluded, that is not on the list, is living in Israel. He doesn't include that as one of the mitzvot to live in Israel. Nachmanides severely criticizes him for this, and he describes it as one of the commandments that the Rambam forgot. Right? Obviously, Rambam didn't forget it. He deliberately left it out. But the question is why? Especially since in the Mishneh Torah, he writes things about Israel. He says, if you want to buy land in Israel, the only time to do it is on Shabbat. You can tell a non-Jew to write the contract on Shabbat. Normally, you can definitely not allowed to do that. Right? Get your stocks or real estate in Borapak, you cannot do that. But to buy land in Israel, that's from the Talmud, but Maimonides legislates that. He talks about it's better to live in Israel in a city which is a majority of Gentiles than to live outside of Israel in a city which is a majority of Jews. He says the sages love the very earth and stones and sand of the land of Israel. And he writes this, but nevertheless, he says he doesn't list it as a mitzvah. Why is that so? So you wouldn't be surprised to know that there is controversy about why. There are some who say that he says it was only applicable at the time when we had kings. And indeed, in the future, we'll have a king. In the future, then it will be applicable. But when there's no king in the time of exile, the mitzvah is not applicable. Hence, it's not an eternal commandment, and therefore it's not one of the 613. There are others who say that he didn't list it because it's too comprehensive, meaning it's a commandment which forms the basis of all the other commandments. Because the only place that we can ideally fulfill every single one of the commandments as a Jewish people, there's only one place you can do that, and it's not Brooklyn. Right? It is the land of Israel. Right? The land of Israel is the only place where all the Jews can fulfill all the commandments. That's it. Period. No one argues with that. So therefore, if that's true, this is a commandment which is not, you can't list it as an individual commandment. It's got to be listed as something which is, it's all encompassing. It's the basis for the other commandments. Something interesting, I don't know if we have time to get into it, but Maimonides, the first commandment is belief in God. But what's interesting is, it's written in Arabic. He doesn't use the word belief. He uses an Arabic word, a'atakad, which actually, a'atakad, I think, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, or i'atakad, something like that, which actually he says in the Guide for Perplexed means da'at, which means knowledge. Not belief, but knowledge. It's a bit of a difference, right? Because, and it's interesting, some say that the first commandment cannot be belief in God. Belief in God is a prerequisite for the commandments. How can you have a commandment without a commander? Right? So unless you believe there's God, right, there's no such thing as a commandment. So it's a prerequisite. So just like but he can list knowledge of God, because that's something we have to work on to get to a level of knowledge, that's. Right? So what's interesting is, similar to belief in God, which is a prerequisite for the commandments, so too, the land of Israel is the background upon which all the other commandments are painted, so to speak. So you've got to have, so therefore, there's a lot of controversy about that, but that would be an example. So his list of commandments generated a lot more Torah, but it became very, very accepted and authoritative. And actually he intended it as an introduction to his most famous and major work, which was completed in 1180. It took him 10 years to write it, 1170 to 1180. And it's known as the Mishneh Torah, which means the teaching or the repetition of the Torah, which is his book of the ultimate halacha book. Ultimate. Why? Because it has absolutely everything. Right? That is to say, you could build a nation on this book. Because it starts with the laws of belief, philosophy, knowledge, idolatry, right? Torah study, tshuva, repentance. It goes through the laws of prayer, tzitzit, tefillah, mezuzah, its Torah scroll. It goes through the laws of all the festivals, how to create the calendar, how to calculate the calendar. It goes through all the laws of business ethics, jurisprudence, setting up the court system, laws of testimony, punishment, etc., etc. It goes through everything you can imagine about kashrut and the laws of animals and ownership and transfer of property. It talks about the laws of the temple in detail, sacrifices, everything, absolutely everything. It also talks about the laws of kings, right, and the appointment of kings and how to administer the country and the laws of combat morality and how to run a Jewish army. And he talks about, it ends with the laws of the Messiah. So pretty much, right, if you wanted to, like, the whole, it's the complete Judaism book, right? And he wrote it deliberately in Hebrew because he wanted it to be something that would not be limited to the Arabic-speaking Jews, but would be something that was universally could be read by the Jews. He also left out sources, got a lot of criticism for that, because he felt it would just complicate things. He wanted it to be a book where, in order to be a good Jew, you wanted to know what to do in your life. All you need is this book and the Torah. Obviously, you want to learn about Judaism, you need other books, because you want to delve into it. But in order to just act the life of a good Jew, his Mishneh Torah would be sufficient. He wrote it in 14 volumes, and that's why it's called, one of the reasons, Yad HaChazakah. Yad means hand, means a strong hand, but Yad also is the numerical value of 14. 14 volume Mishneh Torah. An amazing book that literally, there's not one area of Jewish law that is not covered in the Mishneh Torah. Nothing. But the Code of Jewish Law, for example, is not nearly as comprehensive, because the Code of Jewish Law only deals with the laws applicable to us in the exile. Maimonides writes as though the Jews are living in Israel with the Sanhedrin, right, etc., etc., and there's a king and the whole thing. Now, for him, that's the ideal. Rav Yoshua Ber Soloveitchik points out, if you look in his Laws of Haggadah, when he talks about the Haggadah, he starts off by saying, here, the son asks the following questions. He asks, why on this night do we only eat roasted meat, and on other nights we eat any meat? Why on this night is it only matzah, on other nights it's chametz and matzah? I'm sorry? I start at 8:30, I usually go till 9:30. Isn't it?
Yeah,
1 hour class?
It was started at 8. I don't know what happened.
At 8 o'clock? I was told 8:30.
You were told 8:30?
I was told 8:30.
Oh, no wonder you said the last thing.
I had no idea. I'm sorry, start at 5. I'll take 5 minutes. I'm sorry. I was told 8:30. I'm really sorry. Okay. In any case, for me, it's 3:30 in the morning, so whatever. Anyway, so let me just go through his major works, then we'll end with that. He wrote after this, in 1188, he wrote a book called Dalal al-Hirin, which is in English, well, Hebrew, Moreh HaNevuchim, The Guide for the Perplexed. By the way, The Guide for the Perplexed, he wrote in his introduction, he says, I'm writing this for someone like you, my student, Yaakov ibn Vaknin, his student, and he says, I'm writing it for you, someone who has studied the entire Torah, both written and oral, all the Midrashim of our sages. You've studied logic, you've studied mathematics, you've studied sciences, you've studied literature and grammar and music, and now you have some questions. In other words, it is not for some guy, right, coming out of Pomona College saying, dude, is that an Aleph? The guy for the perplexed is for someone who actually has questions based not on ignorance but on knowledge. So it's a very, very complex, interesting book, divided into three sections. The first section gives philosophical explanations of terms in the Torah, like God, like the hand of God, like God spoke, like mercy, justice, fascinating. The second section basically deals with the philosophical foundations of belief in God, the fact that he is one, and so on and so forth. The third section, which I find the most accessible, is where he deals with his rationale, reasons for the commandments, reasons for the commandments that don't require, that could be satisfied even a skeptic. Sociological, psychological, fascinating reasons for all the commandments, which are very, very interesting. In the third section, Guide to the Perplexed, that was written in Arabic, 1188, translated into many languages, and that created great controversy to the extent that there were people in Provence, in France, who were so opposed to this book, because he used so much Aristotelian philosophy, and he used a lot of metaphor, etc., they actually had the book burnt. Tragically speaking, one of the great rabbis, Rav Hillel of Verona, who was a student of some who actually had the book burnt, he says later on, they regretted it, because later on, remember, you may have heard of the famous burning of 24 cartloads of Jewish books in France, in Paris. He says it was that, ironically, but divine providence, when the Gentiles burnt 24 cartloads of Jewish books, by the way, at a time when every book was handwritten, he said 24 cartloads, that was the same place where years earlier Maimonides' books were burned. He said God was telling us something by that. He was telling us something, you start doing stuff like this, it's going to come from outside, it's going to get even worse. So that was the Guide for Perplexed. And then, of course, his collected letters. Let me end with this one beautiful letter he wrote here at a non-Jew called Avadia, Arab, who converted to Judaism. And he writes three questions to Maimonides. Maimonides answers all three. What's interesting, number one, it's a little sensitivity here. All his letters, almost all his letters, were written in Arabic. But here, to an Arab, his three letters are written in Hebrew. Why? The answer is, it's being sensitive. He doesn't want to, here's a man who's converted to Judaism. He's writing to him. He says, you're my brother, I'm writing to you in Hebrew. He doesn't say that. He says, he's writing in Hebrew. It's a clear reference to the idea that this is now, you are an Hebrew, as they would say in English. Right? Now, one of the questions he asks is that, can I say in my blessings, my God and God of my fathers. He says, here I am a convert. Are they the God of my father? Not the God of my fathers. He's not the God of my fathers. Can I say this? Maimonides clearly says, you are clearly allowed to say that because you are a child of Abraham. We are a child of Abraham through physical descent. You're a child of Abraham through spiritual descent. And then he says, Al yihyei yichuscha kala ba'enecha. Don't let your yichus, your genealogy, be light in your eyes. Sha'anu mityachasim, we trace ourselves back to Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. You trace yourself back to he who spoke and created the world. Very beautiful letter, right? You know, so I just love that line, right? Don't let your genealogy be light in your eyes. We trace ourselves to Abraham. You trace yourself to God. He says, and that's pretty good. That's pretty good. So,
speaking about that, the Muslims also trace themselves to Abraham because of Ishmael.
But that's irrelevant. So what? Of course. So what? They're wrong.
Because of Abraham.
But that may very well be what they claim. And the Christians say that the true Jews and the 12 apostles instead of the 12 tribes. But that's neither here nor there to what the truth is. But we're talking about the truth here. Maimonides is writing to this guy and telling him the truth. Right? And the truth is, he says, you are a descendant of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. Right? That is, by the way, the Torah says, Ki b'Yitzhak yikareh lachat zerah. For Isaac, your children shall be called. Which means that excludes Yishmael. So whatever the Muslims say is totally not a concern to me. Okay, but it's not via Ishmael. Right, they have to come through someone, go straight from Abraham, it's not cloning, right? So through Ishmael, they're excluded, right? So he's talking about, but it's distracting me from what, we're talking about the letter, and in the letter, he writes about this Muslim, this Muslim who converted, he says that your genealogy is even superior to ours. He says, yes, we're descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He says, but you, Atamik Yaches, you are descended, or so to speak, Lamisha Amar Bahai Ha'olam, to he who spoke and created the world. Okay, we have to stop here because it's my mistake, I'm sorry, but I thought it was 8:30. Okay. Oh, the other question, it's a long answer. One question was whether Islam is monotheistic, and he said it is. And the other question was whether the sort of thing you share.